following episode of The Naturalist has been brought to you by Cane 5 Vineyard. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports the Heritage Radio Network and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
Hi, this is Bernie Wides and Carol Butler on The Naturalist Show. Carol, I should say your name first from now on. That would be nice.
Okay.
Carol Butler and Bernie Wides doing The Naturalist Show from a beautiful downtown Bushwick. It's a beautiful morning. The sun is shining.
It is indeed.
And to start off the show today, I'm going to talk about something happening right in this neighborhood of Bushwick and Greenpoint. Newtown Creek, which isn't too far from here. I've never been there, but one of these days I'll have to take a ride over and see it. It's just like Gowanus Creek. It was used many years ago as a waterway, and both of them got pretty highly polluted. So the federal government had decided to call it a Superfund site. That means that it's eligible for funds to clean it up. And Mobil Oil, who's been polluting it for all these years with oil in the ground, the ground is really saturated with oil, they've been slowly sucking the oil out all these years. But now they're going to intensify their effort, and there's funding for it, but it'll probably take 10 years, I figure, to clean it up where it's as clean as possible, considering that the water comes from the East River.
Right.
And the East River is not that great, but it's better than Newtown Creek. So I have this article from the Brooklyn paper, which is a local paper. And it's from November 15th, and it says, City tightens ban on Newtown Creek kayaking. The city has suspended boating from public sites on Newtown Creek, a move that potentially wipes out recreation on the polluted waterway. I'm going to have to take this frog out of my throat.
Okay.
We'll have to see what kind of frog it is.
It's probably a frog that survives in pollution.
In pollution, right. Okay, so what the city has said, you can't kayak on this creek anymore. The Environmental Protection said its short-term ban on launching boats from city-owned sites would remain in place until the state analyzes the creek's water quality. You would think by now they've done it. They've known about pollution in this creek forever. Right. The move comes 2 months after the federal government listed the 3.5-mile Newtown Creek as a Superfund site, beginning a decade-long hundreds of millions of dollars cleanup. So, of course, the federal government is going to do it with Mobil and probably with state agencies. So we know it's going to take a long time.
Well, those Superfund projects are very, very long.
Yeah.
And we wrote about them in the Salt Marsh book. If I knew you were going to talk about it, there are a lot of them in New York, and they're very slow and lots of fighting for years.
All the groups fight about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyhow, Matt Mahoney, an official with the Department of Environmental Protection, said the city was banning recreational use of the waterways out of an abundance of caution with regard to public health. And that's a quote from his what he said, an abundance of caution. It's an interesting way to put it. But frustrated community members and environmental advocates castigated the agency for deliberately crippling recreation on the creek without having any public health data. No kayaker has been hurt or gotten sick after years of use of the public waterway, said Catherine Schmid, head of the Newtown Creek Alliance. The city, as well as the kayakers, have known the state of Newtown Creek's waters for years, and the city felt no compunction to limit access based on the information that they already have. The timing of the announcement arrives paradoxically as other city agencies are investing in ways to expand public access along Newtown Creek, including a renovated park at the end of Manhattan Avenue and a proposed boat launch inside the ground floor of the Greenpoint Manufacturing and Design Center. So the city is planning all these places to use the creek, and now they're saying, We have to stop you from using it now.
Well, but it's because there's somebody new who's responsible for it. And in the design of the Superfund project, right, there's responsibility now, which there wasn't before, I guess.
Right. So the city has already moved to prohibit boating at Newtown Creek. Prohibit boating at Newtown Creek Nature Walk, So there's already a nature walk there, which the city manages, where community members discovered a no kayaking sign in the park's entrance a month ago. Although community members think that the restricted public access is simply about liability in the post-Superfund world.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, we have been aware of pollution for a long time, said Greenpoint resident Laura Hoffman. Now that it's a matter of money, the Department of Environmental Protection can suddenly care. The agency will hold a public meeting in December for community members to air their concerns about the policy change. The yet as unscheduled meeting should be lively, said Community Board Member 1, Dewey Thompson. We're not going to take this lying down, said Thompson. Well, you can take it sitting down, but not lying down. This is bull, he says. There's going to be a very big reaction from the people who use this creek, who have stewardship over this, and now the city goes ahead with a misguided plan to ban even temporary launching of kayaks and canoes on the waterway. So I think, as Carol said, this is looks like a bureaucratic thing.
Right.
That now that there's a liability thing involved, once it's declared a Superfund, they don't want anybody to use it.
Right.
But that means that nobody will use it for 10 years. That's ridiculous.
Right.
And these kayakers and canoeists have been using it for 10 years already, and nobody's gotten sick or even fallen
right.
in.
Right.
So, you know, we canoe and kayak on polluted waterways all the time. In the Hudson, which is in better shape than Newtown Creek.
Right.
But there are two boating clubs. There's the Downtown Boating Club, and they have a branch now in the mid-50s. And actually, the city gave them a terrific facility to keep the kayaks because their old home on the Hudson River, those piers were taken down because they're going to rebuild them.
I always see them when you take the ferry from Lower Manhattan, from Wall Street to IKEA. You see people kayaking in that area, which is Brooklyn, in that whole lower bay.
Right. So, who knows? It's progress, but it's progress, and I don't think they're doing it properly. I think they should have a provisional permit to paddle on the creek and use it, and that's it.
Well, you should go to the meeting and raise hell.
Okay. We'll have to find out when the meeting is. This was from the Brooklyn newspaper.
Hasn't been scheduled yet. I'm sure you'll hear about it.
Yeah. I think if they're smart, they'll wait until after the holidays to schedule a meeting because now we're, you know, busy season. Okay, so survival, we survived Thanksgiving okay, Carol?
We did. It was wonderful.
You have a lot of company?
I did. I was thinking about how many turkeys got killed all over the country.
Yeah, well, it's a sacrifice time for the turkeys.
Right.
And remember what I said about the name turkey from my last show, where the name turkey came from, that when the Spaniards came here to North America?
Oh, yes, it was an unfamiliar, strange bird.
Yes, it's a native bird of North America and Central America, and they had never seen it before. So they saw people eating it, and they caught them and raised them and shipped them back to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bird from Africa that people had been eating, and that was shipped through Turkey to Europe. So they referred to it as the turkey bird.
Right.
So this one, the turkey, looks something like it. It's a guinea hen or guinea fowl, which is almost as big as a turkey, the African ones. And it looks like a turkey. It has the same kind of funny head, you know, like a red head and all that. So that's how the turkey got its name. If you didn't listen to my show on turkey, you missed that. Too bad. Well, we have it now.
Right.
Okay, so now I'm going to shift gears and talk about some very nice little articles I got from Science Weekly magazine. The first one is about Florida. Now, at this time of the year, many people go to Florida. And a great place to go if you're going to Florida is to go to Everglades National Park. It's really a great park. And you can see what Florida used to look like before they drained the swamps and built the houses and all that stuff. So if you're looking for natural areas, Florida has terrific state parks and federal parks. And what you can do is you can write to the Florida Parks Department or whatever it's called, and they'll send you a booklet on all the state parks in Florida.
Didn't you work in Florida, in the Florida parks? Tell us what you did. I mean, that's interesting.
I worked in Everglades National Park as a park ranger about 15 years ago. I was an interpretive ranger. That means I gave tours and tours on a boat through the islands and hiking tours and canoe tours.
Very good. So you have a lot of credibility when you advocate this.
And when I was working in the park, I'm going to talk about this critter. The Florida panther was a big item in the culture there. Mm. Everybody loved the Florida panther.
Did you see them?
I never saw one. I saw one in a rehabilitation station down there. Because when I was down there, which was about 15 years ago, there were only 50 left.
Oh, okay.
And they're very secretive. They're carnivores, big cats. And they do most of their hunting at night, late in the afternoons, and during the day they sort of hide out. So it's a big problem with the Florida panther because this small gene pool. They've been inbreeding for years as their gene pool goes down. And the problem is when you inbreed, any diseases that you have in your gene, defects or recessive genes, and they breed with another panther that has recessive genes, it becomes
more likely to get recessive.
So they were coming up with really serious diseases, and they looked terrible. And this one I saw in the rehabilitation looked okay because they were really taking care of it. Mm-hmm. But the problem was that it's not a viable population for these cats. So what they did was they brought in female kittens of the same species from Texas. And people, a lot of local environmentalists didn't really like that idea because they wanted their pure Florida panther
sick or not.
Right. But and you know they have these license plates you can buy in Florida, which supports wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get a manatee license plate,
right.
A Florida panther license plate, and some other critters. I don't know. Maybe there's an osprey now plate. I don't know. But that money's supposed to go for conservation. So everybody that I used to see had this, the cougar plate, as they called it, the Florida cougar or panther. But most people have never seen it. So the idea was, since the population of Florida was getting smaller and smaller and smaller, was to bring in animals from Texas. It's the same species, the cougar or panther, and they brought in six female kittens that they were going to raise and let go and increase the population. And now it seems to have worked. And now instead of calling it the Florida panther or the Florida cougar, they call it the Floritexan panther.
Oh.
Floritexan, because it's a blending of Texas and Florida.
Yeah.
Okay, but it turned out to be a good idea. Florida's adult panther population has tripled. And this guy, Johnson, who was doing the research, said that the wildlife managers put the adult population in the 90s. Now, when I was down there, it was in the 40s.
Right.
So and even the 90s is not enough to sustain a population, to make it grow.
Well, of course, until you get too many, and then it becomes a problem.
That's the problem. Yeah. Is enough habitat for these 90 panthers or 100, or probably their target would probably at least 300 or 400.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, if you've been to Florida, how civilization has encroached on the parks. I have this poster I still have from when I worked there. It showed the Everglades in a glass jar surrounded by developments.
Right.
A very fragile ecosystem.
But the Everglades is protected, right? Is that?
It's protected.
Indefinitely? Is that?
Yeah. It's a national park and it's forever wild protection.
Right.
But the problem is that the water supply for Everglades has not been protected. And a lot of pollution comes from the farms, the dairy farms, and runoff, agricultural runoff. But they have made a start. Congress passed a plan to restore the water to the Everglades, except that it wasn't funded, you know, because the times are bad. Florida's economy is terrible. So it was partially funded, and around Orlando, the Kissimmee River, which flows south to the Everglades from northern Florida, which had been channelized.
Mm.
That means they put it in a concrete thing like a canal.
Oh, okay.
And that was not good because seasonally it would overflow its banks and all those nutrients and water would slowly run down to the Everglades.
Mm-hmm.
But once you channelize it, then the water runs out into the ocean and then it's lost.
Hmm.
So they've done that to part of the Kissimmee River.
I've seen that in that area because I didn't know what they were doing. But you see these big concrete cylinders that they're burying all along the roads, and that's probably for the runoff. That's to take the water to the river, yeah.
Right. So what they are doing is freeing the Kissimmee River. So it's its normal water course, which is a meandering stream, and it overflows its banks, which is good because all that overflow, what doesn't seep in the ground, slowly goes south towards the Everglades. So that's that's enough for a whole show on the Everglades because it's a very complicated ecosystem. But if you're going to Florida, go to Everglades Park, go online, and you'll see all the great sites. And if you have any questions about Florida or the Everglades, you can write in to me under the comment section, and I'll be glad to give you some advice and tell you what the best places to see wildlife.
Where's the best place to fly in if you're going to the Everglades?
Probably Miami or Naples.
Okay.
If you don't want to deal with a big airport like Miami International, which is really a big, complex airport, you can fly to Naples, which is on the west coast of Florida. Right. It's a much smaller airport. I think JetBlue flies into Naples. And let's see, we have about a minute left. So we're going to jump now, just for a minute, to another topic that I saw this nice article in. It's called Seals with Tags Map the Seafloor. Oceanographers with Flippers Probe Depths Near Antarctica. This is also from Science News Magazine, which comes out every week, and they try to keep you up with what's happening. So it seems that, you know, there's a lot of research going on in Antarctica now, and they're trying to map the sea bottom of Antarctica to see where there are, if there are any canyons down there, any other things that will affect the flow of water. So what they do is they send down these remote vehicles called the Alvin, and there's all these ones now with instruments,
right.
And they do bathymetric recordings of the bottom. Bathymetric means that it's on the bottom of the sea, like benthos, which is the deepest part.
Right. Benthic organisms live on the bottom.
So what they do is they map it with radar. But they found out they can do it much cheaper with seals and elephant seals.
Hmm.
So what they do is they have this population of elephant seals and other seals. And what they do is they cement a instrument on the top of the head of the seal. And if you look on the site, on the tags, I sent Jack a picture of one of these seals with this with this little gadget strapped to the top of its head. It might be like a GPS for seals.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Maybe so.
But what it does, it maps the contour of the bottom. So they found out that using these seals, they can do it much cheaper than sending these remote vehicles down and sending divers down and all that. And, you know, the waters around Antarctica are really pretty cold.
I'm trying to think about how that would work because it seems pretty random to have it on the seals.
Well, what they do is they use a computer simulation with it. So they say 1 out of 5 dives for these seals, they go all the way to the bottom.
Mm.
So when they can... And they could check the depths because this gives readings in depths.
All right, that I can understand.
And pressure and
just like
the
taking
contour.
Soundings here and there.
Right.
Okay.
So it says that seals, walruses, whales, and other large marine creatures have been moonlighting as oceanographers.
Right.
Scientists typically glue sensors to the animal's fur to measure factors like temperature and salinity. The new work is the first to extract bathymetry. That's a tough word to do. Information on the seafloor's shape from the sensors, which also measure pressure and hence depth. You can actually map the ocean floor, said team member Donald Costa. The data comes from 57th elephant seals. Just a word about elephant seals. They are huge animals, elephant seals. They could weigh 2,000 pounds.
Right.
They're bigger than your ordinary seal, which probably weighs 150, 200, 300 pounds. But I don't know if I did a show on elephant seals. Maybe I'll do another show on Antarctica where we saw elephant seals, or also in Baja California. They're huge, and they're very powerful mammals, and they can dive down very deep.
Mm.
So they used elephant seals.
Right. So I can see it. It's like I'm picturing like a radar scope, right? And you're getting, instead of the altitude, you're getting the depth of each point.
Yeah, right, like sonar.
Sonar,
underwater at sonar.
Yeah,
or side-scan radar they use. Okay, so the tags, which do no harm to the animals, record information every few seconds and relay it to scientists via satellite. About 30% of the time, seals dive all the way to the bottom. With enough dives, researchers can deduce where the seafloor lies. And what they found is they found some deep underwater, like riverbeds or canyons, that the water flows through. And they're wondering whether that will affect the melting of the glaciers mm-hmm. in Antarctica, which is a big thing now because right. of climate change. The glaciers are melting, even though Antarctica is one huge, huge ice shelf. All of Antarctica is covered with ice, and in some places it's a mile thick. Mm. But on the edge of Antarctica, the glaciers and are melting. So that's a problem, because if we get enough glaciers melting, then we're going to have sea rise,
right?
Which everybody talks about. What floor do you live on, Carol?
Second floor.
Second floor. Well, you're not too bad. I live on the sixth floor.
My office is in the lobby, though, and it's below ground.
That's so bad news.
I'd be out of business.
Yes, well, I'm recommending to get life preservers right. to use around. And, have a little kayak in the lobby, just in case you have to
Unless
get out.
Unless they outlaw kayaking in the Greenwich Village.
That's right. Probably would do it in the village. Okay, so that's an interesting little article about seals and other marine critters that they're using. But by the way, it does no harm to these animals, because right. what they do is they glue it to the fur, and when it's molting time...
Oh, they shed it.
They shed
it.
So it's
sounds like we need to take a break.
Yes. So we're going to take a break, and we'll be back in a minute. And I'm going to talk some more about some other articles from Science Magazine, something about pterosaurs, and I won't tell you what that is, but you probably know, and about bacteria and some other topics. So we'll be back in a minute. Hi, here we are back on the air. Carol Butler and Bernie Wides, and the show is The Naturalist. And the first segment, we spoke about Newtown Creek. And if you have any responses to that show, we'd be glad to hear from you. And maybe you could fill us in when that meeting is going to be, and we can announce it over the airwaves. And then we spoke something about some critters that are working for NOAA, which is the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, and they are doing research on the seabed floor, or the seafloor bed, I should say, in Antarctica, and they're using seals. And if you missed that part, well, you know, everything is archived, and you can get it, too. And then I did a little bit on Florida cats, the Florida panther, or cougar, as it's called, and now you have to call it the Floratexan panther, because...
I have to get used to that.
Floratexan. Because they're bringing the females in from Texas, and they're... I can't say interbreeding. They're breeding, because it's the same species, so reviving the populations. So I'm going to talk about two more things in this segment, or three things. And the first thing I'm going to talk about is bacteria. Now, we all know about bacteria. Some bacteria cause diseases, but most of them are pretty beneficial to us. We have them in our gut, we have them in our bodies, and they help us digest our foods, and they do all kinds of good things for us. And so there's always research going on about bacteria. Since they're so tiny, so small, you have to use a really good microscope to see them. So this article is called, "Sure, but Can They Chew Gum Also?" Okay? Videos catch microbes walking around on tiny hair-like legs. Now, that's something that...
Unbelievable.
That's unbelievable, right.
You think of cilia.
Right.
Right? I mean, that's...
It's like cilia.
Related.
But they're calling them pili, P-I-L-L-I. Mm-hmm. So what it is, I'll read you some of this article because it's nicely written. Mm-hmm. It's by Tina Hessman Say, and it's from Science Magazine. Jokes that open with a bacteria walking into a bar just got a little less far-fetched. So some bacteria can stand up and toddle away on tiny legs, a new study shows. The findings were reported in Science Magazine. Could help scientists better understand how some bacteria form dense, antibiotic-resistant communities called biofilms and may lead to a better way to combat such microbes. Okay, well, bacteria have this ability to form what's called a biofilm, which is something that's completely covered with one layer of bacteria. And it's a very thin film because these bacteria are so small. And the problem is that it's very hard to dislodge them from this biofilm or get rid of them because they're really strongly attached to this surface. Right. And it's a real problem with some diseases to get rid of them.
So now we know that they dig their toes in.
That's right. So we scientists are interested in when the bacteria get up and walk around, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. And if you look on the tags, you'll see this diagram of a bacteria walking and sort of trace lines that these scientists have traced. Okay, let me tell you a small bacteria. Bacteria is probably 1/1,000,000th of a meter. Mm-hmm. Okay? So a micron, I think, is 1/1,000,000th of a meter. But if I'm wrong, Jack, you can correct me. Is that right? A micron? 1/1,000,000th of a meter. Jack shook his head, so that's good. Thank you. Okay, so anyhow, so scientists want to understand better how they can disrupt this biofilm, so get rid of it. Researchers had already documented bacteria swimming through liquids.
Right.
But that we see under the microscope. Or crawling on their bellies.
Hmm.
But no one had ever seen bacteria get up and walk until a group of undergraduate students, how do you like that?
All right.
That's terrific. At the University of Illinois made a video of Pseudomonas. You know, all these bacteria have these great science names. When you write the name out, it's bigger than the bacteria.
Right. It's sure.
Bacteria on a microscope slide. Working under supervision of Gerald Wang, a biophysicist, now at UCLA, the students adapted a technique used by physicists to track microscopic particles. Computer programs allowed the researchers to quickly sort through footage of teeming bacteria. My students started seeing all this neat stuff, Wang said. They'd tell me, yeah, sometimes they just pop wheelies and stand up. So visualize the bacteria popping a wheelie. It's pretty bizarre, right? The bacteria's unsteady walks require the use of hair-like appendages called type 4 pili, P-I-L-I, the team said. These stringy legs, in quotes, were already known to be used for twitching motility, okay? A type of locomotion in which pili at one end of a bacterium will pull the cell across the surface.
Okay.
So scientists had already known that.
You're thinking about them sliding around rather than getting up on this pili.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and we think of them in liquids, you know, sort of swimming and moving around. But it says it's almost like front-wheel drive, Wang said. These crawling bacteria move in relatively straight lines over fairly long distances. Now, what's a long distance for a bacteria that's 1 micron in size?
Right.
An average of 6 microns.
Okay.
They were walking.
Then they're exhausted.
Then they have to take a break.
Take a nap or coffee break, right?
You know, I think maybe maybe Starbucks can get in on this and you know, have an espresso break or what's the other one? Dunkin', who always America runs on Dunkin'. Is that the thing?
That's correct.
Maybe they could hire these bacteria.
Could make a very small cup. Yes.
Right. Okay. Possibly enabling the microbes to move toward chemical attractants, which they may be moving to. In walking mode, a bacterium first stands on splayed pili. Splayed is, you know, when your legs are spread apart at the bottom, give you more stability. Okay. Tugging on one of the pili sends the cell lurching in that direction. Okay. Bacteria covered more ground and move faster walking than crawling, the team found, which may help them explore an area more quickly. So that's interesting.
It is interesting.
When forming biofilms, bacteria need to attach to a surface and then release if the conditions are unfavorable. So blocking the ability to stand up may prevent biofilms from forming on medical implants and on other surfaces. So that's the problem, medical implants. You know, if they're putting something in your body, they want to make sure that it doesn't have bacteria on it, which could cause a lot of problems.
So they have to make the surface slippery?
They have to do something to the surface so they can't attach to it.
Right.
Well, like you said before, maybe they're digging in their pili. Like,
right.
We don't know if they have little graspers at the end of the pili.
Right.
I don't know. The picture here just shows like a little stick, straight stick. Okay. Walking is not an uncommon activity for bacteria, the researchers have found. After cells divide in two, you know, bacteria reproduce by binary fission, where the cell just divides in half, and then you have two new individuals. And then that cell divides in half again, and it goes on and on and on. And that's way from one bacteria, you could end up with a million in a short time. Okay, after cells divide in two, about 67% of the time, one of the newborn cells will move away from its sibling, often by walking. Now, how do you like that? They've been attached. They've been one cell together.
Right.
And now it's a separation.
Right. Talk about separation anxiety.
That's right. They get up and walk away.
Right.
Carol, maybe you could do some therapy for these guys.
On bacteria, yes.
Right.
I'm thinking about it.
Yes, you're having trouble with your office? You don't need much room for bacteria.
All I need is a biofilm, right?
You need a biofilm and a little, you know, platform.
Right.
Okay. The bacteria even moved in three dimensions. How's that? Standing and launching from the surface, said this guy John Kirby of the University of Iowa. It's like the earth was flat, but now it's not flat anymore for bacteria.
Unbelievable.
Because they can launch themselves up and stand on two legs and look around. So if you ever think about bacteria, well, here's some more to think about.
Why don't you think about them in a different way?
In a different way. Here they are, they're able to move around more. So
I wonder if that's characteristic, if that's unique to that specific bacteria, or if it's something that we probably don't know yet, but something that we'll find is common among many varieties of bacteria.
Yeah, yeah, it doesn't say that. It just said that they use this one, this one with the fancy Latin name here.
It's okay.
Yeah, it's okay. Right.
Illinois bacteria.
Illinois bacteria. And you think it's something just happens in the Midwest?
It could
I
be.
I don't know. Maybe the ones on the coast, they don't do it. I don't know. But we don't really know. See, there's a lot to study, guys.
Stay tuned.
Stay
right.
tuned.
This is a
and
new
if you're looking for research to do for your PhD,
right.
you don't know. And maybe the whole design field,
that's
designing you know, skateboards for bacteria or something like that. But we don't know. Okay, so I'm going to cover one more critter, and then I'm going to talk about what's new at the Museum of Natural History because the holidays are coming are up.
I wonder how much time you have, because we want to talk about the museum.
Yeah. So, Jack, give me a signal when we have about halfway or less, and I'll get to the museum. Okay, one more article. I like the titles of these articles from this magazine. It says, Wide Bodies Flew Cretaceous Air.
Okay.
Okay? Studies suggest that pterosaurs could soar halfway around the globe. Now, a pterosaur is a flying dinosaur. You've probably all seen pictures of them. They were probably in that, what was that movie about all the dinosaurs? Jurassic Park. I think there were pterosaurs in there. They're the flying dinosaurs. And they have like very long beaks like some birds and with sharp teeth. And they do a lot of eating and crunching of stuff. So this article is talking about that they found some very big ones, which I'll tell you about. I saw in Texas. Predating jet travel by at least 65 million years didn't stop the biggest pterosaurs from racking up miles.
Okay.
Okay. They had a mileage program. These prehistoric creatures may have been able to fly 10,000 miles or more nonstop, according to research that was done, and the report was given at the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology. The original elite flyers included four species of what biochemist Michael Habib of Chatham University in Pittsburgh called supergiant pterosaurs flying reptiles, and they give the name. And this is the one that I saw in Texas, Quetzalcoatlus northropi from Texas. I once went to a elder hostel program in Big Bend Park in Texas, and one of our field trips was to Saul Ross University, which is a small university in the southern part of Texas. And they had one of these pterosaurs that they had dug up because there are a lot of fossil pterosaurs in Texas. Mm-hmm. And, of course, since it's Texas, You know, everything has to be bigger
and
better. So they had on the ceiling a reconstruction of one of these terrace stores. It was the size of a fighter plane.
Right, unbelievable. It was enormous.
Really enormous. So that one, they think, could have possibly have been the long-distance flyer. Yeah. Appearing in the fossil record about 70 million years ago, they stood about as tall as a modern giraffe and soared through the air by spreading membrane wings to a span of roughly 10 meters.
Probably gliding.
Yes, gliding, and they were like bat wings, right? Membranous wings.
Yeah.
Like bats.
Right.
And they probably had to take off from a high spot and then, you know, glide and...
Right. But so I'm less impressed thinking about 10,000 miles because a lot of birds make very long migrations.
Right.
And they glide a lot. And look at the monarch butterflies.
Yeah.
They stop, though.
Right.
They stop at night.
Also, the migrating birds stop.
But the bird, well.
Some of them, like the albatrosses.
Right.
Are long distance. Some of them. 6,000-7,000 miles.
That's right. And right. The hummingbird goes across the Gulf of Mexico, which is 500 miles, and there's no stopping
there's
no place to stop, and they don't glide.
No.
So the equivalent is probably, it's probably very equivalent.
Yeah. It says these.
Not that I don't want to take away from these guys flying 10,000 miles, but at first I was. Very
well, you wouldn't
shocked,
want to, well, you wouldn't want to fly in their airline, though.
No,
they have wide body flights, but you know what? These supergiants are big by pterosaur standards. They are truly gruesomely huge by bird and bat standards.
Yeah.
If current estimates for pterosaur body masses and wing dimensions are realistic, and if the pterosaurs could catch thermals and glide the way birds did, just what you said, Carol.
Yeah.
It would make them the longest single-trip distance flyers in Earth's history. Birds such as Antarctic terns can migrate pole to pole, but they have to stop off for fuel to eat. So this guy's calculation raised the possibility that supergiant pterosaur fossils found on separate continents can't...
they might be related.
Probably related.
Yeah.
So that's what he's stressing in this article. A pterosaur from Big Bend, Texas, could be mating with a pterosaur from Transylvania.
Oh, right.
Okay. The mating idea may be a stretch,
said another
researcher.
Then it's called a Texylvania.
Right. Texylvania pterosaur.
Right.
There's a good phrase, right? Okay. So he said that when this was proposed at the meeting, that nobody laughed and fell on the floor because it's a possibility that they were so big that they really could travel long distances without stopping.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was pretty amazing. So when I was in Texas at this great thing in Big Bend, which if you haven't been down there, you should. Big Bend is beautiful. It's a great place. One of the things we did, we went to Saul Ross because it had this great museum with local fossils.
Mm-hmm.
And we helped on a fossil dig down there.
Oh.
There's so many fossils in the ground there of mosasaurs, which is these huge lizards that lived in the oceans. Big, 70, 80 feet long. That was very interesting. So speaking of fossils, I'm going to talk a few minutes now about our favorite museum, the American Museum of Natural History, where both Carol and I volunteer.
Let's just say first that the Butterfly Conservatory is now open, because
that's
our bailiwick.
Yep.
And this is our 11th year.
Yep.
And it's wonderful.
It's as beautiful as ever.
We encourage, even more so, we encourage you to come. It's fabulous.
Right. And it'll be there until...
End of May. 7 days a week, anytime you feel like it. Pop in, you might see us there.
Right, and if you're going to come to the museum and you want a little advice what to see, drop us a line on our tags and we can give you some guidance. Okay, so I'm going to talk about two of the new exhibits first, and then I'll talk about the regular exhibits. The newest exhibit at the museum is called The Brain, The Inside Story.
And you trained to work in there, did you not?
Not yet. I did a walkthrough far. And then I'm going to do some training there. I missed some of the training when I was away in Turkey.
Oh, okay.
But I have all the signage, and we'll study up on it. So it says, I'll read you the description from the museum's little newsletter that they put out. It's called the Museum Calendar, and you can get a hold of it if you want to. Or you can go online. It's all online.
Well, just tell about it, because it's...
Okay. So it says, step into the amazing changing brain. This exhibition explores how the brain, a product of millions of years of evolution, processes our thoughts, senses, and feelings. The journey begins in a tangled forest of 100 billion interconnected neurons. Remember when we went in?
Right. I was going to say we should describe it because it's really fabulous.
Right. Carol and myself Last week, we just took a walk through to see it.
Before it opened. This is one of the good things about working in the museum. You get to go look before. You, when you enter it, it's magnificent. And like the, usually, they do a wonderful job. I'm thinking of the water exhibition. Remember that, where it was just a line of mist and
like
you had to
waterfall.
Go through the mist? So here you come, it's like a fairyland. It has all of these moving strings of lights which represent the nerve cells, the neurons. And dendrites in your brain.
Right.
And it's just all, you're all surrounded by this, like you're in the brain. It's really magnificent. I just wanted to stay there.
Yeah, it's very nice. It's very, I don't know, mind-blowing.
Yeah, it really
is. You could stand in the middle of it and... It's a real experience. It's very nicely done. And I don't know if they have 100 billion interconnected neurons there, but it looks like at least 10,000 in the exhibit. Okay, so it's very nice, as Carol said at the beginning of it. And it says, find out how the highly developed neocortex allows humans to make plans and predictions as well as engage in symbolic thought. That's what humans can do, and we don't think any other creatures can really do that, right? Symbolic thought and predictions. Unless those chimps haven't been telling us everything.
We do it. We probably do it better than other animals, but there are animals that have some of those qualities.
Discover how advances in brain imaging and biochemistry are deepening the understanding of the emotional brain. Learn about the brain's plasticity, which is interesting because we never thought that, you know, you could grow new neurons.
Right.
And that's especially interesting for seniors because if you keep your brain active, it still makes new neurons and these... connections. It's continual transformation through different stages of life and how new knowledge about the brain's inner working may help scientists repair and improve brain function. Stop along the way to challenge your brain with interactive puzzles and games that probe your neural connections and pathways. Folks, if you hear some noise in the background, they're putting a new roof on onto Roberta's restaurant here, making the restaurant bigger. That's what the noise is. And it's registered on our brain. So anyhow, it's a terrific exhibit, and I'm going to train to work in it. And Carol, I think if you have company, you should
get them
to see that brain exhibit.
My company is only interested in shopping.
Oh, shopping.
So they never go anywhere. I have not been able to get them to even come to Butterflies in years.
Okay. Oh, well. So maybe your daughter would come.
Oh, of course.
Okay,
yes.
And some other folks in your circle would come. But everybody should come to the museum sometime this winter to see this great brain exhibit. It's going to be there for a very long time until August.
Right, oh, great.
Because it just opened. Great. Now, the other great exhibit that's there is Race to the End of the Earth, which is about this these two explorers to see who could get to the South Pole first.
When is that one over? Because
that one is going to be there till January 2nd.
Oh, so you better go to that first.
Yes, because
that's a wonderful one too.
That's going to close on January 2nd. So, sometime between now and then, go see the Race to the End of the Earth. It's about Antarctica, and Scott, the English explorer, and Amundsen, the Norwegian explorer, how they prepared to go to the South Pole. It was to see who could get there first. And all the preparations they made, and there are a lot of things that a lot of mistakes that Scott made, and some mistakes that Amundsen made, and there's a great deal to learn about that exhibit because what it does is it compares the two teams, their equipment, and it shows.
But more than compares them, you're asked to choose.
Right.
Well, I love that part of it. It's so clever. You choose one of the teams that you believe is going to win. And I really didn't remember the history, and so I chose wrong.
Tell people.
No, I'm not going to say it. But you choose either the one of the teams, and you pick a card that represents that team. And then as you go through the exhibit, you kind of get invested in what your team has done, and you want your team to win. And then you find out little by little in the different displays the problems that each team had, and you find out at the very end which team actually made it first.
Right. And actually, with these cards that Carol is talking about is, you know, you pick them up. There's a little film at the beginning that you should see. It's a very good introduction. Then you pick up these cards, and you become one of the crew members, actually, of one of the teams. And you follow them through the expedition to find out what happened to them.
But it's really very engaging, though, to do that, because I don't like things like that. Usually I pick up the card, and I don't really take it seriously. But somehow by choosing
Right. You become part of it.
You really become part of it, and then it makes it much more interesting.
Yeah. So that's two of the great exhibits at the museum. Now I'm going to talk about, Carol said, the butterfly exhibit, which is probably our favorite exhibit there. We both work in the butterfly exhibit. And remember that we have, on the average, 500 butterflies from all over the earth, except the one continent that doesn't have butterflies, which is
Antarctica. It's always, if anybody says what continent doesn't have X, it's always Antarctica.
Right. Also, we have a diamond on exhibit there now called the Wittenbach
Diamond. Oh, I have to go see that.
Diamond.
Yeah.
Yes, it's in the Hall of Gems and Minerals.
Right.
It's called the Wittelsbach Graff Diamond, a unique and exquisite blue diamond that weighs 31 carats and boasts a rich history in the royal homes of Europe. So that's on display, and that'll be there also till January 2nd. So if you go to see Antarctica, leave some time to get to the other exhibit of Gems and Minerals.
Let me just add one thing about butterflies. Or what did you have another exhibit?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
What we also have in butterflies that people love is we have a pupa case where you can actually see the butterflies in the chrysalis, in the last stage of the caterpillar stage, where they metamorphose. And we have hanging pupa, chrysalids, of all different species, the domestic butterflies. And if you're lucky, when you get there, you will see one that's wiggling, and you might see a butterfly come out, which is really a big deal. And then we have cocoons from some of the big moths that we have in the exhibit. And we have cocoons in the bottom of the pupa case. And sometimes we've seen that, which is just very exciting when you see a moth come out of the cocoon.
Mm. And, you know, moths have bad press. People get very nervous when you talk about moths. So come and see some beautiful moths.
Right.
And then you won't feel worried about them. And moths don't do any damage. There's only that one little species of moth that eats woolens.
Right, there's a couple of species of clothes moths.
Yeah,
I think there are three species.
Yeah.
But the moths we have are in a particular family that doesn't have mouth parts.
Right.
So not only don't they eat your clothes, they don't eat anything and they don't drink anything. As adults, which is amazing. The larvae, of course, eat a lot.
Yeah.
And then when they metamorphose, they have big fat bodies. And they live for a week off their body fat.
Right.
Their only task is to find a mate and lay eggs.
Right. And we have the world's biggest moth.
We do indeed. Atlas moth.
Which are spectacular.
Which can be 12 inches across. They're really huge.
Right. And the last thing I want to mention.
And they're not flying around. We don't have to freak anybody out.
No.
They're sitting on the window. They're nocturnal. So they always sit very still wherever they are, and they don't move the whole time.
They don't move the whole time, so you don't have to worry about them attacking your new wool coat.
Right.
But as Carol said, the adults don't eat anyhow. It's in the caterpillar stage is when they do all their eating, in the larval stage. Okay, and we have a beautiful IMAX movie. It's going to be there till January 9th. It's on the Hubble Space Telescope. And if you haven't seen it, Carol, it's really spectacular.
I haven't seen that one, yeah.
You should go
see
it.
Oh, I like the IMAX movie.
Yes, and this one is particularly beautifully made.
Mm-hmm.
And, the launchings and the usual stuff.
Right.
But it's really, the photography is spectacular.
Okay.
So go to see that before it leaves on January 9th. And if you can't get there after January 9th, well, there'll be another one coming up.
And you should also think about volunteering at the museum, because if you're a volunteer, you get to do all these things. When it isn't busy, you can go into all of these special exhibits as a courtesy instead of paying for them. Normally, unless you're a member, you have to pay to go to some of these things that we're talking about. So volunteering at the museum is very worthwhile.
Right, and that's very easy, too. If you go to the website and click in volunteer, you'll get the phone number of the volunteer office, and you just show up and...
There's an application online.
There is one online.
I did
That's good to know.
Yeah.
Okay, it's good online. And so then you can go anytime you want if you're a volunteer and see all the great stuff.
And you also get to go to all the other museums.
Right.
Since we seem to have time, we might as well recruit for the museum.
Sure.
You also, with your museum identification, you're welcomed in most museums in the city with guests.
And even out of the city, too.
There are
some museums.
And really treated very nicely. I'm always struck by that. You're treated like family when you go to the Modern or the Guggenheim. and it's very lovely to do that with visitors.
Yeah. Okay, I think we have about a minute or two left, and I want to talk about 1 minute left. Okay, Jack. There's a Kwanzaa celebration at the museum. They have it every year now. And this it says, this vibrant all-day celebration honors the seven African-based principles of Kwanzaa with performance and so on. All that. Well, that was done already. It was December 26th. But I think there's still is there still an exhibit on it? I don't remember. But
it's usually events on a weekend.
It's events on a weekend.
Kwanzaa, yeah.
So keep that in mind for next year then, because that may be finished. Okay? And there's also something on the brain and Tibetan art.
Mm.
That, they have a collection of Tibetan, like tankas, you know, those beautiful
stuff. Oh, those are beautiful, yeah.
And we don't have time for any more.
Now the construction guy is singing. So
yes. Yes, we have a show here today. There's a guy, one of the construction guys working on the roof. He's very happy, singing along. And he's drinking his coffee. So we're going to sign off for this program. This is Carol Butler and Bernie Wides. And we'll be back with a new show next week. Carol, what's that show going to be about?
Bizarre Things.
Oh, Bizarre Things. Okay, she doesn't want to tell us. It's a mystery show, but it has to do about some evolutionary things that we have incorporated into our bodies.
Right.
Like the secret of mitochondria. Bum, ba-dum, bum.
You're giving it away.
I won't give anything
Stay
away.
Stay tuned.